This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we explore venture debt funding as an alternative for startup funding and review angel-list data on diverse seed stage investing being the best way to invest at the earliest stages. This show was recorded on December 19th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
So Graham, you were up really early this morning. What were you doing?
Well, in my defense, I did go back to sleep after that, but I was up really early this morning, and also Tuesday morning. At my family's business, we decided that as a show of our appreciation for our employees, that we wanted to buy them breakfast, lunch, or dinner, depending on the shift that they are on. And our manufacturing company runs 3 shifts a day, 5 days a week at 2 different facilities. So on each of Tuesday and Thursday today, our management and ownership team kind of joined forces to serve breakfast, lunch, or dinner to our employees at 4 a.m., noon, and 8 p.m. respectively.
Goodness gracious.
So I'm 5 out of 6, excuse me, I am 5 out of 6 meals served with one more to go later tonight.
So how long have you guys been doing this? Is this is a holiday tradition, I'm assuming.
Yes, because it's a holiday. Look, I'm in a room where a clock is chiming. I guess I didn't really think that one through before choosing my recording location today.
It's okay, Graham. What's in the show is in the show.
And it's chiming 5 at 4. 4:56. Cool. So that clock must be in a different time zone. So we've been doing this off and on when the company has had good years for the past handful of years or so. We used to do some other things around the holidays, and because of kind of a growth spurt we went through, which required us to kind of put some additional capital into the business. We reduced some of our other holiday kind of benefits. And so this is something that we added back as we got through that that kind of growth spurt.
Nice.
We also do a family day, which is Saturday. So we invite all of our employees and their families to come out and do kind of holiday stuff. Santa will be there. There will be a bounce house. You can decorate cookies, all kinds of fun stuff like that. So yeah, several hundred folks to come through hours. So yeah, it should be good.
It's a lot of people.
Should be a lot of fun. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Scooped a lot of mashed potatoes over the past couple days.
Got that big potato energy.
Yeah, that big potato energy.
Well, this is the show.
Glad
that we had that little opening bit. Graham, we have two absolutely scintillating topics to discuss today. We are going to be talking a little bit about and Graham, feel free to correct me in real time in case I really mess this up. We're going to be talking about a new venture debt fund my colleague at work, Marianne, had written about from ScaleWorks. And we are also going to be talking about a very in-depth report from AngelList published last week-ish ago. Time sort of runs together, Graham. You know,
the title of the report, I think, just says December 2019.
Sure.
I don't know if that digest has a different date.
Well,
December 11th, 2019. So,
well,
yeah.
Well, sometime. We're not going to compromise our OPSEC about when exactly we're recording this or when exactly this is going to get released. So we're going to be talking about the AngelList report. We're going to be talking about venture debt from ScaleWorks, but less about ScaleWorks in particular and more about venture debt in general. So Graham, I think before we get into any of that, we should probably tell our vast and fabulous listening audience a little bit about who we are. I can lead.
That would be great.
Wonderful. So hey everybody, my name is Jason Rowley. I am one of your co-hosts here on Fully Vested. So for my day job, I am a venture capital data journalist for Crunchbase News, where I munch and crunch Crunchbase data to answer big questions and uncover trends about the intersection of technology and money. And then when I'm not doing that, I do a little bit of work with the Python Software Foundation, helping them reach out to early stage startups that use Python in new and interesting ways. I am going to just plug that any listener who's interested should apply. You can go to us.pycon.org/2020/event/startup-row, I think. You will have to make a account, but please sign up. Registration for Startup Row closes in the middle of January.
URL just rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, well, if you just Google Startup Row 2020 PyCon some permutation of those of that string, you will probably get it. But Graham, that's enough about little old me. Who are you?
My name is Graham Peck. I am a venture partner with Cultivation Capital. Cultivation is a Midwestern-based seed and Series A stage fund that invests in life sciences, ag technology, and specifically the area that my team and I focus on is software and IT technology. And in addition to that, I also work with a Eastern European software group who staffs technologists for growing companies, growing or large companies.
Nice.
That company is named Brightgrove. Yep.
Cool. Graham, venture debt. This is admittedly not a subject I've been terribly familiar with, although there's been a lot of really interesting new investment vehicles that have come online in the last couple of years using debt or debt flavored sort of investment structures. But it's something that I don't have a giant background or understanding of, and I was hoping that we could chat a little bit about it so that I can learn a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think one of the big things that I really wanted to do here was just give exposure to our listeners to think about funding, and a lot of these funds actually kind of look like venture funds in a lot of ways, but funding that is of a similar ilk with similar kind of expectations of growth, but that's not coming directly from a venture fund. And exactly as you pointed out, there are a ton of great options out there. There are probably even some direct banks that are doing this, but there are companies like Scaleworks, which specifically will include the article in the show notes that your colleague Marianne wrote, but also there's groups like Lighter Capital, who I've met with a couple of times, and other groups that are doing funding for, let's call it, high gross margin services businesses, as well as, and kind of their key niche usually seems to be SaaS or other recurrent revenue business models. And I think it's a great way for startups to get some additional growth funding. I think it's important for them to understand where and when it's appropriate to use this type of growth capital. And while that's not exactly the focus of the article, I think that may be a good thing for us to also touch on. So the article specifically in Scaleworks, you know, indicates that their average loan is around $1 million, but their kind of range of what they lend is, I think, around $200,000 to about $3 million. And so one of the things that I think is important is you're going to have to probably be past like those earlier stages where you're getting a friends and family round, maybe even a seed round, because, with debt capital, obviously there is certainly an expectation that it's paid back. And so you don't want that to be a drag on the business. One of the other things that I think is another kind of key focus area that's really important to understand is I think that these types of debt vehicles only really work when you have a really, really good understanding of your acquisition costs. So I think a startup has to be at a point when they've got product or service, it's in the market, they're at least beginning to gain traction with some of those earliest customers, but they're also far enough along in that customer journey that they know how they can deploy capital effectively and how many new customers that's going to go get them.
Right.
So that I think is an important, I think that's the hurdle. Those are the kind of steps and stages, and whatever funding, bootstrap or otherwise, you need to do to get there. That's the stage that I think a company needs to be at for this to be an appropriate a piece of their overall funding or capital stack.
Yeah. So it's sort of like a company going out and raising, what we'll just sort of generally call like quote unquote growth equity, you know, which could be, you know, like a later stage, you know, venture round like series, you know, even something like, you know, series B, C, D, you know, somewhere in there, where a company has sort of hit product market fit and there's a repeatable business model wherein people know to some relative level of certainty, you know, with notable caveats for everything in business is always uncertain. You know, the bottom can fall out of an economy at any moment. At least for right now, our current president is still the president. Like, there's all sorts of.
Oh boy.
Hey, look, I'm not gonna touch the impeachment stuff with a 20 foot pole.
Let's not open that Pandora's box, please.
No, not again. I mean, that's what we mentioned on our almost friendship ending podcast episode.
Very true.
Okay, but anyways. You know, it's this idea of like, okay, we've hit this repeatable business model. There's a certain level of predictability here. If we take, you know, $100 and invest it in growth, you know, we have a reasonable expectation of getting, you know, $100 plus some extra, e.g. from the growth, back, you know, as revenue or other, you know, depending on whatever metric you're trying to use here. It seems like, though, the advantage to venture debt, Graham, is that it is it's funding without necessarily as much of the dilutive effects of a fundraise from a traditional venture capital round, right? Wherein you're selling stock to you're originating new stock and selling it to investors. To raise capital. Is that my understanding is right? Or,
well, I mean, I think each deal maybe is slightly flexible, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if there are some venture debt or revenue-based financing folks out there who maybe take some options or warrants as a piece of the total package that they offer to you know, startups or growth phase companies.
Sure.
But I think that that's exactly right. Most of the ones that I've seen, including, again, specifically at least Lighter Capital and Scaleworks, they do so with very, very light touch control provisions, probably a simpler process to get your business funded than a traditional bank. And they don't take those two specifically claim that they don't take any ownership or control. So they're not sitting on your board. Obviously, I'm sure they've got some dominion to pull their payments out of your accounts or something like that.
Sure.
But they don't have any control of the operations of your company, the board that operates it, your executive team, and they don't take any ownership. So again, while there could be exceptions to that, and somebody may take some small warrant package or something like that.
Yeah.
In general, these groups are exactly as you said, Jason. I think that's what startups see these as a option for them that's really favorable. So I think a couple ways that it could be used is it could go alongside an equity injection, or I think that also it could be used in lieu of or as part of, but really in lieu of a bridge round, right? You see a lot of companies come to a point, and we haven't dug into the specifics, I don't think, on any of our episodes of why or how convertible notes are kind of typically used. But one of the advantages, really for everyone's benefit long term, if you have the right pricing and provisions in there, but really for mutual benefit of the company and the investor long term of a convertible note, is you kick the can down the road on the valuation because you're not valuing the company. And this has some of the same benefits without ever having the expectation of conversion, which you get that same dilutive effect as taking an equity, right? A convertible note vehicle, is a debt instrument, but with the full expectation that at some point in time, usually 12 to 36 months from now, or maybe sooner if a round happens quickly, but no more than 12 to 36 months from now, that that's going to convert into equity in the company. It's a debt instrument until then, and we just don't define the price of the company. We give you some capital now, you can use that to grow into what we'll all agree is an appropriate valuation in the future. I think these venture debt vehicles can allow a company to do very much the same thing and grow into a higher valuation without worrying about any of the concerns of dilution of ownership or board, executive team, or otherwise control of their company. So I think a lot of companies will see that as really favorable, you know, in today's world.
Yeah, for sure. So basically, you know, the core advantage of this is that you're not you don't necessarily need to assign a price to an asset that might otherwise be difficult to price. So in the case of like a very early stage company, right, not a candidate for venture debt, like I'm talking like just past, you know, idea stage, you know, like just, you know, hacking out an MVP, yada, yada. That's when you'll see a lot of these companies raising unpriced rounds through convertible notes or safes or whatever. And that's because those their assets are basically impossible to put a price on. You know, there's the whole there's a side discussion to have, probably not on this episode, about valuation caps and discounts and the dynamics of those instruments in seed funding in particular. But in the case of a company that needs to go out and raise, let's say some venture debt, maybe in lieu of a bridge round, are they doing so because otherwise they might not receive as favorable a valuation, do you think? Or are they doing it strictly because, it's an opportunity to have, you know, non-dilutive growth capital? Or is it kind of a little bit of column A or a little bit of column B?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to anyone's specific motives,
sure.
But my gut instinct is it's probably a combination of those two things. And I think one of those, if I'm understanding the two things you proposed correctly, I think one kind of begets the other, or one is a symptom of the other. So, yeah, I mean, I think that this may be seen as a way to help grow my company into a higher valuation. And in theory, I retain more and or set a higher price per share, you know, at a future round. And you know, yeah, exactly. The article that we will link in the show notes,
yep.
You know, specifically mentions a threshold in this case of $1 million of recurring revenue. Obviously, you know, there's probably a lot of nuances to the way that you can actually look at what is technically recurring versus recurrent or predictable revenue. I don't know where they fall down on that.
Yeah.
Lighter Capital's FAQ, which we'll also make sure to link to them in the show notes, you know, says that generally this is best suited for companies doing at least $200,000 in annual revenue, and that they require an average of $15,000 of MRR for the last 3 months. So that has to be a 3 month MRR or monthly recurrent revenue average. Although obviously $15,000, that doesn't even quite put you at $200,000. So, you know, again, this is not for like two guys and an idea on a napkin. Again, it's for a business that's probably got multiple customers, has a product or high gross margin service in the market and receiving revenue, and is confident that if they had some amount of capital, you know, between $50,000 and $3 million, that they could scale that business further. So, while I assume that I don't think there's any control provisions from either of these on what the capital is used for, I would assume most of the companies who are taking this capital are also using it primarily for sales and marketing purposes,
mm-hmm.
because, again, since they're having to pay it back out of their future revenues, it's very likely that they are that they are using it primarily for the purpose of generating more revenue. Although I'd be surprised also if there's not some of it that's broken off to additional product development, customer support, other things like that that may not be direct revenue generating activities, but that also, I guess, support that additional customer growth.
For sure. What else do we want to talk about venture debt, man? Did we just like put a nice tidy little bow on it?
I hope so. I think so.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I guess my kind of closing point there is just that, you know, I would encourage a lot of folks out there, again, as long as you're at the right stage and phase for this, to consider venture debt as one option as you continue to look at all of the options out there. And that especially in lieu maybe of a potentially messy convertible note, maybe consider a venture debt situation to help you grow before your next. Your next price round. So,
got it. Well, actually, wait, Graham, I do have one last question.
Sure.
Which is from your perspective as an investor, do you see, is there a positive or negative signaling value to a company having raised a sizable amount of capital via debt? Like what goes through your head when you see it on a cap table or in some other sort of disclosure from a company? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously debt probably wouldn't live on a cap table again unless it came with some sort of options or warrant provision. It would probably be on like a balance sheet or again, some other form of a disclosure schedule. You know, I mean, we see it's really common that early stage founders loan their companies money that they expect to get paid back. And occasionally we're okay with a portion of our capital proceeds going to that. And or some form of a secondary sale. It seems like those types of more sophisticated things are becoming a little bit earlier in the capital life of a company.
Yeah.
So I would say typically at a seed or series A stage, which is where we're investing, that's not something, and maybe we'll follow on through around a B or so, but typically that was kind of B and later, and I think it's moving a little bit earlier. We're seeing even late seed rounds or early series A stage rounds having secondary buyouts. Mm-hmm. But to actually go back to your question, I'll respond for myself personally, not for our whole team.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know that none of our portfolio companies that I'm aware of or work directly with have used a vehicle specifically like Scaleworks or Lighter, although I know a couple of them have definitely looked at it to my knowledge, although some may have, and I certainly wouldn't be clued in on every single one of them and whether they've taken some venture debt. Overall, I would say my only hesitation or concern, the only thing I would see as potentially not positive of a company having used a vehicle like this would be, well, I mean, obviously, if they've had some trouble and not grown the way that they expected or not hit numbers.
Yeah.
But other than that, my general rule of thumb personally, and this isn't even just for venture, this is actually true in kind of the private equity world as well. But I think as long as your net margin and growth rate are each higher than your average interest rate of your whole debt side of your capital stack, then I think you can afford to use debt to grow. Where I have been personally disappointed, and this isn't things that I've done necessarily with cultivation, but I've seen some businesses that get on a high interest rate debt treadmill where they're using new debt to cycle out old debt, and they end up trying to, and if again their net margin is either negative or not higher than the average interest rate of their total kind of capital stack or debt side of their capital stack, and their growth rate isn't high enough to also exceed that, if both of those don't remain true most of the time, I think businesses can work themselves into a little bit of a situation where they're always just trying to run faster, but the treadmill is going pretty fast or accelerating itself. And I think that they can get themselves into some trouble. So that's certainly something that if we took a pitch from a business that had debt, we would want to dig deep into what the terms are and things like that and make sure that this wasn't a dramatic inhibitor of future growth and that there was a really solid repayment plan. But again, I think, you know, some of these groups are coming in and finding models that are really flexible and I think do a pretty good job of not inhibiting future growth. And some of them, you know, again, Lighter Capital actually specifically calls their funding revenue-based funding. And so they say that we take 2-8% of your monthly revenue until we've been repaid some multiple of the initially put in capital that's between 1.35 and 2. So that's actually interesting to look at. So, I mean, said another way, for every dollar of revenue you bring in, is it worth having a capital injection that you can burn so that you can, again, this is why I say you probably need to spend most of it on sales and marketing and focusing on growth, but so that you can bring in more dollars. And for every dollar you bring in, as long as 92 to 98 cents of it is enough for it to be worth it, then you're giving up 2-8% off of the top. But as long as you're able to afford that on an ongoing basis until you've paid them back their aggregate multiple, then I think you could actually grow your business pretty nicely on capital like that. So that's a little different way of looking at it than an interest rate, although you could still, I think, impute an interest rate there. Yeah. And again, my general rule of thumb for all businesses out there that, you know, that would listen to this is I'd suggest you make sure, again, your net margin after all expenses and your growth rate both remain higher than your average interest rate.
So that you obviously have that spread.
Right. If a startup's burning capital, should you take on debt like this? Maybe. Obviously, you don't have a net income percentage then. But again, I would be sure you know your... If you are not profitable, I would be sure that you know your metrics really, really well and you know the repayment terms and you know that you're not going to get cycled onto a effectively high interest rate treadmill that you can never afford to get off of.
Right. Well,
but if you know your metrics and you know putting $100K to work or $1 million to work, like ScaleWorks average loan will net you what, $1.5 million, $2 million of new revenue over a defined window of time, then maybe that's a great vehicle to use, especially if you have a very high gross margin and an increasing net contribution margin as you scale.
Totally. Well, speaking of Graham, this is not a thing that I sent you when we were prepping to record this, but as a little quick real time follow up, Tuesday, you know, one of our favorite company to talk about on this here show, WeWork, had secured a $1.75 billion line of credit from Goldman Sachs, which replaces a previous set of credit lines totaling approximately $1.1 billion, at least according to reports from Reuters and Bloomberg, which I relayed for Crunchbase News. So that's to your earlier point of like, if there's a company with like, let's just say challenging internal economics, losing money like nobody's business, because I guess it is maybe quite literally nobody's business at this point. You now see a situation where, you know, they've taken on, you know, even more debt now. So who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But obviously, the WeWork situation is materially different because it is hopefully a relatively unique anomaly in the world of venture investing and venture returns. That it is very different from the sorts of much more small scale scenarios that that we're talking about with still relatively early stage companies that have achieved product market fit but just need extra working capital to continue growing their businesses. So,
yeah, you know, and I think one of the really interesting points there on WeWork, just for one more second, is that I think what caused WeWork to initially try to IPO, which was, I think, kind of the beginning of the end for the prior echelon of WeWork leadership, was actually trying to raise enough capital to access a debt facility that someone else had promised them. I think there was originally an offer, I'm not sure from whom, but for $6 billion of non-dilutive debt financing, if they raised $3 billion through public market offerings or other capital injection sources. So that's kind of what I think, you know, was leading them to the dance floor to go to an IPO in the first place, was the promise of $6 billion of debt capital. Anyway,
and now look where they are.
Right. And now the business as a whole is valued just slightly over $6 billion in theory.
Well, $8 billion, which is hilarious for a company that has raised about $8 billion in equity funding to date, if not more. Well, technically more. Anyways.
I was going to say, haven't they raised more like 18? But anyway, yes, to your point, very, very different situation than a small, you know, growth stage startup with somewhere in the 200K to couple million dollar recurrent revenue business that's wanting to throw a little gas on the fire. Again, my comments about net profitability probably don't apply to them. That's the kind of rule of thumb I use when looking at an acquisition or PE financing. You could probably still take one of those away and say you still at least have to be growing much faster. And for a non-profitable company, know your unit economics really, really well before you take this as kind of bonus rocket fuel. But in the right scenario, I think that this type of growth capital could be really helpful. And again, allow entrepreneurs who are often sensitive to dilution, entrepreneurs or founding teams, to maintain control of their companies. So I think it's likely we're going to see a lot more quote unquote funds or groups like this come out to support the growth of startups in the future. And I think that's great overall, as a just another participant or another tool in the tool belt of supporting small businesses. So
yeah. Graham, let's make a little pivot to this really interesting AngelList report. I think we've I predict this is not the last time we'll end up talking about venture debt on this show. And specifically, I'm very eager to get into some more of those dynamics on convertible instruments and other sorts of like sweeteners that might be added to an otherwise strictly debt financing to make the deal palatable to both entrepreneurs and their investors. But we will save those discussions for the next one or whenever we discuss it.
Yeah. I think that'd be a really good topic for us to focus on, because I think convertible notes are can be a great instrument and are often misunderstood. But
create weird little dilution dynamics once everything ends up converting.
Oh boy, do I have stories that I probably, for the most part, can't disclose or tell about that.
Well,
yes, have seen a lot of those where. So one quick word of caution on that note.
Sure.
I would encourage any startup founders or founding teams out there to kind of keep a live running cap table and always pay attention to, especially the caps at which your convertible notes convert. And a lot of times, I think people think that they're doing themselves a favor by not triggering those conversions, because I think they think that they're continuing to kick the can down the road. excuse me. And what I would say is that if you have a very low conversion cap and you don't convert that note, but continue to raise on extensions of a note or even raise at a then higher capped note, eventually you will have to have a priced round. Or it's very likely you will eventually have to have a priced round, or some investor will come in and require basically you to trigger a priced round. And at that point in time, you could actually end up having diluted yourself and your founding team down quite a bit because of not triggering those ultra low caps. So anyway, just word of caution is pay attention to your caps. And there are a lot of times when I think people's gut instinct is to continue to kick the can down the road and say, we will price this later. And you're not always helping yourself out depending upon what the caps are and how much you've raised and interest rates and some other things like that. So,
got it. Makes sense.
That would be the quick warning. We'll dig in a lot deeper in the future.
Sure. Yeah. No, I look forward to that. Okay. So from the world of venture debt to the world of, seed stage and beyond venture capital, Angelist released a report a couple of... Well, within the last couple of weeks, which has a bunch of really interesting findings. I think the biggest takeaway line from it is that instead of that, seed stage investors are best served by quote investing in every credible deal unquote that comes their way, rather than being ultra super duper selective about the types of deals that they invest in, right? So it's sort of like this, it's the dichotomy between, you know, people who say that they're really good pickers of companies versus the somewhat, I guess, derogatory phrase, you know, that sort of spray and pray approach. And I think that there's a lot of, I mean, it's a long report. The blog post sort of summarizing it's only a few hundred words and only has a couple of charts, but the actual report's like freaking 26 pages, including the title slide, mind you. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff to get into here. But Graham, super high level, like what are some of the things that you took away from this report that you found were most interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you covered what was the most obvious thing. And to extend your quote a little bit on the front end, the subtitle of the article is, if you miss the best performing seed investment, now out of quotations. So if you're not a really good picker, now back in quotations, you will eventually be outperformed by someone who blindly invests in every credible deal. And now ending that quote. So again, I think that really says it all, that unless you think for some reason, and there's a lot of smart people out there who are, and there's a lot of people who think they're smart and probably aren't very good pickers, but unless you're just absolutely phenomenal at knowing at a very, very early stage who are going to become the biggest companies or the most successful performers, then basically, you should just blindly invest a little bit in every deal. Now, again, they do go on to say credible, and then they do say you could also, I think if you dig into the data that's included in the full study, they say, well, you know, if you just start throwing money at every single company, you're going to end up funding a bunch of stuff that wouldn't have otherwise gotten funding. So we recommend you have certain thresholds, although they don't contemplate what any of those are. And they do also note that they have a relatively small data set here still for determining something of this size. I think that one of the things, I'm a numbers geek, but not a like hardcore math analysis geek. Although Jason, I think you are.
Nope. Nope.
Oh, well, all right. I guess we're not.
I just make, Graham, you got to understand some stuff, okay? One, my job is basically doing some filtering and merging and joining and some group buys and pivot tabling and all the rest. There's not a whole, I'm not doing the the super duper fancy like statistical regressions or those sorts of model or that sort of modeling yet. That I'd have to go back and resurrect my knowledge from some intro statistics class I took in college. But anyways, continue. This isn't so not a where did we leave off here? The quantitative model?
Well, yeah. So I was just going to say, you know, that again, they recommend that you have some criteria, you know, and again, I think they're looking at around 500 deals, maybe just less than, mm-hmm. and only a couple hundred that have follow on. There's a lot of information in the detailed report contemplating basically power laws, which I'm only, you know, moderately familiar with, but basically makes the point that to establish a true power law, they probably need a data set around two times as big as the one that they used to create this article.
And for everybody listening, just a quick, very quick primer on primer.
Oh boy.
No.
Probably
a
primer.
It's primer. Sorry. I've been listening to too many British podcasters who say primer. Anyways, a brief primer on power laws. Basically, it's the idea in so many words that, you know, 90% of the returns come from 10% of the investments. Or that 90 that sort of imbalanced 90-10 relationship can exist in other sorts of fields, not just finance. But again, it's shorthand, 90% of the returns come from 10% of the investments. So, and sorry, Graham, I know that you were going to say something, but, to the earlier point about bigger data sets, like this is the challenge that I encounter every day, you know, at the day job, you know, working with venture capital data, is that so often, you know, you'd say, oh my God, we have this data set of, you know, X thousand well-funded companies or whatever, but you'll realize that, you know, for all of those companies, you might have a bunch of companies whose funding data sort of starts at Series B and beyond, or it might start at seed, but there's like a couple of missing dollar values for Series A and Series B. And then you'll see, oh my God, the company raised like $60 million at its Series C round. And so you can't use, you have to throw out those, you know, those companies with imperfect records of financing to do these sorts of analyses. And so I'm very empathetic to the data science team at AngelList, you know, when they say that, gosh darn, you know, if only we had a more complete data set here. So,
well, right. And to that point, I think that in this case, they were only using companies where there was a positive kind of valuation moving, or the valuation was moving up from seed stage on. And they needed to know, so they also needed to use companies where those data sets or valuations were disclosed. So I think those were all kind of some of the hurdles that they, you know, kind of leapt over. And so their point was, yeah, there are many thousands of funding rounds that happen through AngelList, but we're not looking at ones where the company either fails or there are down rounds in the future. We're only looking at when there is positive valuation trajectory that's disclosed, seed, and then higher valuations later. So I think one of the other big takeaways for me was that there is also that this isn't true past seed stage, and that's really an important distinction. So if you're investing at the seed stage, then if you don't get the best ones, you should blind, unless you believe you can get the best ones and you're a really great picker, you should just blindly invest in every credible deal. That is not true if you are investing beyond the seed stage.
Right.
So if you're investing at an A or a B stage, or later, then you should absolutely be reliant on your ability to pick based on some combination of factors, including, of course, industry experience. Although this article article also kind of says that industry basically doesn't matter, again, for this premise, but based on your industry knowledge, obviously, is a sorting criteria. But then from then on, you need to basically trust whatever your model or thesis of your fund says, if that's something that's going to lead to success, to determine what is and what isn't a fit. So again, it very specifically, Jason and I, of course, are not attorneys, accountants, or representing any specific investment here. Of course, talk to your advisors and family and whomever else you need to before making any investment decision. We wouldn't recommend you go blindly invest in every seed stage deal you get pitched, nor does this article, which has a couple of pages of lengthy disclosures at its end in its appendix. But all of that being said, this is only true at that earliest stage. And it kind of points out two main reasons for that, which I thought were really interesting. And I think those are that it gives it more time to mature, and kind of the effect of compounded growth over some number of years until that startup eventually exits. And also that there is disproportionately more of the value created in those really high growth early years that again then gets compounded even as the growth rate slows in the later years. And so I think that they were kind of saying those two factors, which go kind of hand in hand, are really what makes this true about that early stage investing at and before the seed stage kind of.
So you said this a little earlier, but I think it's worth mentioning again and then having a little bit of a discussion about it. The report says that statistics show, at least, you know, based on their analysis of their particular data set, that if you have a credible deal come to you, that you should probably just invest in it, obviously assuming that you have the capital, you know, set aside to do so, yada, yada. But they never really get into this issue of, well, what a credible deal is. And I think that this might be a very good way for you and I to close out this episode, is a short discussion of at least from our own perspectives, what credible means in this case. So obviously there's the idea of credible means that, you know, there is a decent chance of financial and business success. But what are some of the things that investors might look at to determine whether or not a particular deal opportunity is credible or not? Like, what are some of the that y'all look at? And again, not necessarily speaking anything particular about cultivation or your experience or your own personal investment criteria for stuff, but at least in the abstract, what are some of the things that you might want to be paying attention to when assessing the credibility, quote unquote, of a particular opportunity?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's some easy low-hanging fruit there. Number one is, you know, is there a big enough market? Like, are you going to attack a problem where there's a chance, and we all believe that there's a reasonable chance, you could actually build a good-sized business out of this? I think that's certainly important, just as kind of table stakes to be considered credible. One of the other things that I think is a pretty common threshold, and probably some venture capital firms have even higher thresholds, and I'm not speaking specifically for cultivation here, but a commonly used threshold, I think, is to say that I have to see the possibility that there's at least a 10x case. I'm not saying every deal is going to get 10x. Obviously, most of them don't. But you have to at least see a path to some eventual 10x valuation case, right? So if I'm investing at a $2 million, post-money valuation at a really early seed stage, or maybe even a $4 million, you've got to see a way that the value of that company ends up being 10x that. Mm-hmm. Those are some easy kind of low-hanging fruit things that definitely, I think, stand to make a deal credible. Although it's much less It's much less clear, especially in the early stages of getting to know someone. I mean, a lot of early stage investing is also about the people. It's probably hard to define whether a founding team is or isn't credible. It's probably got to be a gut instinct thing. And maybe that's not one of the types of criteria that for this blind spray and pray investing style that they would actually use. And you're exactly right. They don't go into a lot of what they mean by credible, although they recommend, again, that you have your own credibility standards, because they kind of point out that you would probably create a lot more losers if you just throw some nominal amount of money or maybe some non-trivial amount of money, but at every deal that you see, that's not what they're investing or recommending. I guess one of the other things that's kind of on the same point, but isn't exactly about a definition of credible, and I'd love to hear what you think some of those credibility thresholds are too. Mm-hmm. But one of the other things that's kind of related that I think about is that even if you invest in, we can debate intelligently, I think, what the credibility thresholds are. But even if you invest in every deal that crosses those thresholds, the number of deals you're going to see is still relatively small compared to the total number of deals out there. So I guess, and this is a question that probably we could answer with data and what your anticipated total portfolio size is. But I mean, unless you're going to go and, contribute some amount of money to every funded angel list deal that there is, which would be a non-trivial probably amount of money.
That's a huge amount of money.
Right. Even if you were investing a very small amount per deal, that would be a non-trivial amount of money. And more importantly, that would probably take an army of people. Even if you were doing no due diligence, that would take a lot of work because of the sheer number of deals that there are on there.
I think, and so one
of the things that the article specifically advocates for is not lowering any thresholds for non-accredited retail investors to be able to invest in any one specific company, but the article actually advocates for the creation of an index vehicle that invests broadly on your behalf in every deal that's out there, every credible deal, again, given whatever their definition is of credible, on your behalf, and that you can buy in a small way, you being any retail investor, in a small way into a highly indexed vehicle that goes out and picks every startup that they can that fits the definition definition of credible. And I think that's a great idea, by the way.
Oh, for the record, little old me is a non-accredited investor, who is at some point seeking to gain exposure to that asset class, which, yes, I understand is very high risk. The money that I put in has just as much chance, if not more, of maybe not totally disappearing, but at least, perhaps underperforming similarly allocated assets, say in the S&P 500 or similar. I think that seems like something I would very readily buy into as a retail investor. Obviously, maybe not so obviously, but presumably AngelList is making that point because they want to be the platform that facilitates or creates that sort of broad index fund like structure. What's up?
Well, I was just going to say, it doesn't mean that it's a bad premise, though.
No, it doesn't. Not at all.
In fact, again, I think it's a very good idea. And I've seen some people try to do things a little bit similar. I don't know that any of them have the power, exposure, or kind of just market size available to them that AngelList or maybe one or two of the other most popular, but probably
only AngelList
has the big enough syndication power to do something like that. So, of course they're advocating that they create this vehicle, I'm certain. But again, their own bias towards them creating a new financial product aside, which I totally understand and totally get, I think it's a really cool idea.
Yeah,
and I think
agreed.
It would be great for this asset class to be available to John Q. Public or Jimmy P. Street Investor or whatever initials we want to give that fictitious person.
Sure, sure. The the sort of, well, so now this brings two other points. One less germane to our topic of conversation. One more germane. The less germane one is, I know that this has also been attempted with, you know, building an index of super late stage companies. Like there's the Prime Unicorn Index, which is, I believe, put together by the same group that runs Lanyap Labs, which, among other things, is fantastic at surfacing restated certificates of incorporation from somewhere deep within the bowels of the Delaware Secretary of State. I know that they have a sort of investment fund that invests in very late stage, sort of quote unquote unicorn, you know, $1 billion type valuation tech startups. But you know, to the earlier point about like, you know, where else do we see such a large indexing type strategy? You know, perhaps at the highest end of performance is an organization like Y Combinator, right? Where they have, you know, their class size has just ballooned, you know, from, you know, when they first started, maybe a dozen startups to, at this point, you know, hundreds of startups a year. You know, granted, they're presumably doing some sort of a filtering function during the application and interview process, but really once you get to the top, well, I mean, presumably, I don't, you know, I'm not at Y Combinator. I don't have, you know, inside information on this stuff, but presumably sort of once you get to the final, like, you know, top 20% or top 15 or 10% of an applicant pool and an interview pool, really it's just kind of a crapshoot to figure out, like, you know, who might, I don't know, like who's your cultural fit or like, or whatever. Like once you get to that top sort of echelon of deals or potential deals, you know, that have been rendered credible through some sort of due diligence process, or deemed to be credible through some due diligence process, that you do see that there are other sorts of institutions out there that are doing this indexing type approach, and I'd be very curious to know what YC's return profile is relative to other organizations that do take a more specialized approach while investing in similar stage companies with similar check sizes. But that is obviously a set of numbers that will probably never see the light of day.
Yeah, I certainly assume so. You know, I know we've covered in a past episode or two some, you know, data that had been leaked to public sources. And it, I think it's kind of fascinating to look at that stuff that way. But yeah, I assume that information, unfortunately, is not out there, but it would be really fantastic to see it.
Yeah, agreed.
So to go back to the earlier question, in addition to the things that I mentioned, what do you see as some other credibility thresholds, you know, and I know you're not really an active investor,
no.
but what do you see as some things that would deem a startup to be credible if you were to want to use the blind spray and pray approach?
Sure. So, I mean, like as a journalist covering the startup space, like I think about all of the things that stick out to me in press releases, right? If, you know, if the founding team has a, you know, has a history of working at, you know, large successful tech companies where they've had a leadership type role or, you know, had started a new product division or something like that. You know, it's the typical, like, you know, oh, ex-Googlers leave Google to start, you know, some new whiz bang startup or whatever. Like that's a, you know, that lends to credibility. You know, other aspects of founder background, perhaps maybe less so. Like I'm less enamored, personally at least, less enamored with the idea of saying, oh, we only are going to invest in like Harvard and Stanford dropouts, stuff like that.
Yeah, great. I mean, I think that makes sense. You know, one of the things that I have seen other data on, and I don't know if you might know the source of this, but I don't remember where I saw this, but one of the things I found interesting is looking at how many times someone's been a founder before. And I believe the study that I saw says if you've been a founder once before, there is a very marginal increase in the likelihood you've been successful. But if you are a successful multi-time founder, so you have founded two or more companies that have come to successful conclusions, probably being determined as IPO or some sort of M&A activity, that it actually is a statistically significant increase in the likelihood that you'll be successful in your next venture. So that's something that I found interesting. I don't know that obviously a threshold of credibility, though, would be at least one person on your founding team has been a successful serial entrepreneur. And as a side note, I think it's always interesting when people champion the number of times that they fail. And there is, I think, interesting data that you might learn more out of a failure. But I think that same study said the number of times you've failed at starting a company, I don't believe there is any number of failures that increase your likelihood of success in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it also is sort of like, well, what's the definition of failing to start a company, right? Like, Graham, I've had, I don't know, a dozen harebrained ideas over the years, for which I've bought the domain and done all the things. But it's obviously, you know, some of those projects never went from zero to one. Actually, all those projects never went from zero to one in the sort of Peter Thielian construction of this. But it's also debatable whether there was even a switched to zero in the first place in some of these cases. So
yeah, no. And of course, I mean, I've had a ton of those. I would say I'm the founder or co-founder of probably four, three maybe failed or just didn't launch, failure to launch kind of startups.
Yeah.
That didn't go very far. One company I ran off and on for a while, and it was technically a corporate entity, but it was really me freelancing as a consultant. And for all intents and purposes today, that's, wound down, although I technically still have a couple of clients that I do a little work for from time to time. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, is what's the definition of, of a failure?
Of a start. Yeah. What is it? Then we get into the whole like existential thing of, well, what's a startup? What's a failure? What's success? Which we're not going to get into here because we're already running a little bit long. But, you know, really, for me, the other stuff that I just consider is really thinking about things in the terms of like risk. So there's a bunch of different types of risk in seed stage ventures. There's obviously market risk. There's technical risk. There's team risk. There's political risk. There's political / regulatory risk. There's all sorts of different stuff that you have to consider from the risk side. But sort of contra to that is where companies show relative strength, you know, saying, hey, yeah, we're building this is probably a bad example because blockchain startups are weird for a lot of different reasons. But if you're able to say like, you know, hey, we don't have to worry about technical risk as much for our Ethereum based blockchain startup because we have, you know, like two senior core devs of the Ethereum protocol as advisors to our venture, right? Like that is a sort of a vote of confidence. From that market standpoint, you know, it's talking about, you know, to what extent has an idea been validated or not? You know, is it a situation of, you know, two folks, with a harebrained idea, just saying, hey, we want to go out and raise a little bit of money to launch a startup? Or is it a situation where like a founder is solving her own problem by starting a company? There's a lot of different ways to cut that.
Oh, sure. Of course, it's obvious to know that somebody who understands a market, right? I mean, like, let's say that you come from a two-generation, three-generation family that's been in some industry like home building, and then you're going to build a technology platform that enables that to be better. You would obviously be confident that you're familiar with the market problem, right?
Right.
Maybe this lends itself easily to say from the story of mine back at the beginning of our show, why haven't I built some really phenomenal technology for the manufacturing industry? Because there's no doubt that I understand tons of problems that the manufacturing world sees every day. Right. And I would certainly have credible resources and a deep understanding and background of that space, just using me as an example. So, yeah, no, I totally get that. And I think that there's tons of people credibility thresholds. And I do think that that's a huge part of the overall credibility threshold is the people, again, because you're investing at a seed stage. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where it's at. You know, you are investing at the end of the day in the people trying to chase a particular market opportunity. So.
And change the way the world works in some small way.
Sure. Except for WeWork. Different kind of work.
Except for WeWork.
Anyways, Graham, I think that might be a great time for us to wrap this one up, unless you have other fun facts to share. Anything else?
I think that's a good ending point.
All right, man. Well, I'm going to hit call recorder. One, two. All right. This is no longer the show.